Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. You know, every day there's a new gizmo to make life easier and more interesting, which also means every day yesterday's gadget becomes obsolete. But here's one that some of you should hold on to for a while.
Not just yet. It's not going to become a hood ornament just yet.
That's reporter Lisa Napoli with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Lisa says you may still have a need for an old home entertainment standby. So I ask you, what is it? Could it be A, your turntable? Vinyl records are actually making a retro comeback. Or perhaps it's B, VHS tapes. There are still some movies you can't get on DVD, much less HD discs. Or should you hang on to C, rabbit ear antennas for your TV? This despite the big switch to digital broadcasting next year. Give up? Hang tight. The answer's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Fat Tuesdays this week, but probably more important on a personal finance show, it's also Super Duper Tuesday. Time for a look at economic politics across the generations. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
We've been talking for several weeks now about what a recession means to the economy and, most importantly, to you. Recession isn't like inflation where you see it right away in the price of things you buy. No, the biggest personal toll is usually that folks start losing their jobs. And it's happening. Friday's unemployment report showed the economy lost jobs last month for the first time in more than 4 years. Meanwhile, the interview process for the world's top job races towards Super Tuesday on the heels of the Florida primary. John Dimsdale spent the week in Florida talking with a cross-section of voters about their money issues.
Floridians feel buffeted by forces beyond their control, both natural and man-made. The state director for the AARP is Lori Parham.
We call it in Florida the perfect storm. The hurricanes a few years back that have really caused a crisis in property insurance. Property taxes are very high and people are struggling there. Then you had the housing boom and bust. And then you add on top of that gas prices, prescription drugs, health care costs, and people are really feeling squeezed.
At an AARP-sponsored rally in Fort Lauderdale just before the primary, these retirees said they favor candidates who'll bring the government to their rescue.
I want them to come up with something better. I want them to come up with a better way of handling health care than what we've got now. If I knew the plan, I'd be running, but I don't.
No, I don't have any ideas. I wish I had some ideas. I listen to politicians. I watch the news. I'm a news addict, and I'm waiting for someone to come up with. They're not discussing the issue.
Given a severe downturn in home and condo values, most of the three dozen seniors I talked to favor a government stimulus for the economy. On primary day at the polls in Hollywood, Florida, this retiree liked Republican Mike Huckabee's proposal to widen the interstate highway from Bangor to Miami and put people to work.
He's right. That's what we need to be doing right now. As he said, use American steel, American labor, American concrete, and start building these things.
Not all senior voters are looking for a government prescription to solve financial insecurity.
The government has a role, but it's not the nanny.
Jack Davis is a retired government worker in Sarasota. He's a John McCain supporter.
The more we let government take over the responsibility of whether our kids are educated or not, or whether they're learning or not, or whether we're protected from storms, or whether our economy goes up or down, I am one of those individuals that's of the position that personal responsibility is what counts.
Many young voters agree. But some, like Lisa Ostowski, a recent college graduate from Jacksonville, also want the government to deliver on its promises.
You know, when you graduate from college, as I just recently did, it's hard to find a job that has, you know, health care and a 401k and a pension plan, because that really just doesn't exist anymore. And also, Social Security is a big deal, you know, financial security when I retire, because I'm paying for Social Security now, but will I get it when I'm older? I'm not really sure.
Up the coast in Boca Raton, a 30-something MBA graduate calls himself liberal, almost libertarian. Dave Pounder likes Barack Obama and thinks the government should stay out of the way of entrepreneurs like himself. But he favors a legal limit on businesses that outsource jobs overseas.
The analogy I use, if you have a big mansion with 20 rooms in it, and one room has heating in it, and the rest of the room, and the rest of the house is freezing, it's cold, you know, it's poverty, you know, other parts of the world. If you open the door, all the heat in that one room is going to disperse into the entire house, and the whole place will be cold, and nobody wins. So in a way, I'm kind of a proponent of sort of putting restrictions in terms of how much companies can outsource, and things along those lines to sort of encourage jobs to stay in the U.S. to maintain the standard of living. Because if they don't, more jobs will go out.
One area where both young and old endorse a government solution is environmental policy. Everyone I talk to agrees that mandated limits on greenhouse gas emissions might be the only thing keeping rising ocean levels from swamping most of the state. In Tampa, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Super Bowl weekend is upon us. And here's a statistic that's almost as impressive as Tom Brady's 50 regular season touchdown passes. Football fans were expected to buy 2.5 million new high-def TVs to watch the big game this year. But a year from now, that figure could be even higher as viewers scramble to catch up with the TV industry's transition to digital television. A survey out this week from Consumer Reports shows more than a third of TV-owning households don't even know about the big changes that are on the way. Here to help explain is Marketplace's Lisa Napoli. Hey, Lisa.
Hi, Tess.
Digital transition. Break this down for us in terms of our TVs. What exactly is happening here?
Okay, so as of February 17th, 2009, so we've got lots of time to prepare, the government is requiring broadcasters to start pumping out their signals, not in analog, but in digital, which means a snazzier picture, and it means that they can pump out more information to you, meaning even more TV to watch than ever before.
Well, what does that mean for folks who have not made the transition to digital television yet? What happens to those analog TVs?
Okay, so the first question many people will have hearing you say that is, how do I know whether my television is analog or digital? Mm-hmm. Now, as you say, if you're a TV junkie like you, you probably know you've bought your set in the last couple of years. Those sets have come down in price. A lot of people have been buying them. Those are okay. You have to do nothing. But if you're like me and you've got a TV that you've had for 7.5 years now, then you have to worry if you don't have cable or satellite.
And what if you have an older television and you do have cable or satellite?
You're okay for at least the next 3 years. That's how long the broadcasters have to continue sending out that analog signal. Don't worry about that now. The thing we have to worry about right now are the 30 million people, because there are 30 million of me out there, with these older televisions who don't have cable or satellite or one of these newfangled systems that you get through your internet provider.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about this set-top box that we hear about, this converter that will allow people with analog televisions to get a digital signal, and the government is helping subsidize that?
Yep, because the government's forcing this transition. They don't want to force you to have to go out and buy a new TV. So you can go to the government website, which we'll have on our website. Basically, you can get up to 2 boxes per home. The government will subsidize $40 a box. The boxes are somewhere around $60. And this box will attach to your TVs and will convert the signals for you automatically.
So does this mean that I should prepare a plot for my rabbit ears?
I think...
Not that I haven't, but...
You probably haven't had rabbit ears in years. Not just yet. It's not going to become a hood ornament just yet, those rabbit ears. You're still going to need them if you are like me and you have this Model T of a television hanging around your house. Once you get the converter box, you're still going to need to rely on the good old-fashioned rabbit ears to tune everything in.
All right, Marketplace's Lisa Napoli, happy viewing.
You too.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed. We call this Straight Story. Hey, Chris.
How are you doing, Tess?
Oh, we're doing well. So, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about what's going on here with the markets and the credit crunch. And it seems to me like you think this marks some sort of major turning point for consumers.
Well, I really do. And I want to go out on a limb here. You know, for the past half century, consumers have borrowed more and more and more.
Yep.
And they spent more and more. And I think that that borrow and spend economy may be coming to an end, that more and more people are embracing, what do we call it, a new frugality, where the mantra, I want it now, is replaced by this question, can I afford it?
Chris, I'm not really hearing that anywhere. In fact, I have to tell you, one of our staff members here at Marketplace came and asked me this morning about the proposed stimulus package.
Yes.
Because he wanted to know exactly how much he was going to be able to spend when he got his check from the federal government.
All right. So there are some counter arguments, but I'm not completely delusional here. Okay. So hear me out. This change isn't going to happen because people's budgets are tight. No, the main reason for the new frugality is that lenders, financial institutions, have suddenly woken up and said, oh no, these consumers with all this debt, they're risky borrowers. Imagine this, Tess. Now we're forecasting, but imagine this, that your mailbox is free of credit card solicitations and that your credit limit has been cut.
You're not just forecasting, you're dreaming, my friend.
Well, I'm not quite dreaming. I am forecasting. My dream is that this new frugality, which will be imposed on the consumer, not that the consumer is going to embrace it, it's going to be imposed on the consumer by lenders. It means that savings will once again become the foundation of long-term wealth. And investing for the long haul, a phrase we use a lot, will become a reality rather than a personal finance cliche.
But why on earth would lenders do this? Because it basically means that they're not making as much money.
That's right. Well, the latest number that I saw from Bloomberg is that so far lenders have written off $130 billion. And by the way, that figure is going to get bigger.
Yeah.
And they're going to say, well, you know what? The financial services industry is not going to be as profitable as it was. They're going to be a lot more cautious. They're going to look at the consumer and say, you know that credit score that we talk about all the time?
Mm-hmm.
We're raising our standards.
Riddle me this then. If consumer spending is responsible for two-thirds of our economic engine, what happens if people all of a sudden go for this new frugality?
Well, I think that this is a myth that's out there, that if people embrace a new frugality, that the economy will fall apart. Now, I think there are sectors of the economy that will definitely get into trouble, some of the luxury sectors, which we're already seeing right now.
Right.
But actually, the economists who have looked into this, they argue that your consumption over your lifetime will go up. And here's the reason why. All of us, particularly when we're young, we borrow too much. Then what do? You spend the next couple of years paying off debts.
Right.
And if you're not borrowing as much and you're saving more, over the course of your lifetime, you're going to spend more money. Imagine if instead of retirees going into this new stage of life with lots of debt, they're debt-free and they have savings. They're going to consume.
All right. The Straight Story from Chris Farrell. And Chris, we'll be back with you in a few minutes with Getting Personal.
As always, Tess, it's fun.
Just ahead, 401k management fees are stripping tens of thousands of dollars from your nest egg. We'll look at what to do about it. And a financial gift from mom and dad sounds great until you have to step on a scale.
The beneficiary's weight was taken into consideration. If she weighed more than a specified amount, the income from the trust would be cut back.
Guilt and bribery from the grave. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. If you have a 401k retirement plan, you've probably spent the last few weeks watching your returns head south for the winter. But did you know that even in good times, you're still losing? Your returns are getting eaten up by hidden charges, things like wrap fees, soft money fees, and something called revenue sharing. Next week is the final week for the public to comment on new fee disclosure rules proposed by the Department of Labor. And for a closer look, we're joined by pension consultant Matthew Hutchison. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Is it possible to estimate just how much we're all losing because of these hidden fees.
Over a 20, 25-year period, if you are being charged a total of 1% in your retirement account, the ultimate benefits that you'll receive when you retire, let's say age 65, will be reduced by approximately 20%.
So we're talking thousands of dollars.
Over a regular working lifetime, we're talking about $80,000. And to make that shortfall up, a person would have to work 3 or 4 additional years just to break even based on an excess 1% fee.
How high do some of these costs go? Are we talking 3%, 5%?
The average plan, which is really 90% or more of all of the 401k plans in the United States, is paying approximately 3 to 3.5%. However, there are some plans, especially those that are associated with insurance companies that have additional layers of fees added on, I've seen as high as 5%.
Is it possible to figure out how much money you are losing in fees?
It is possible. There is a rigorous way, a scientific way that's based on some rigorous mathematical application where you can determine what you're paying over a long period of time. But a normal participant wouldn't know where to look.
There are some mutual fund companies that have publicly argued, look, if we give people who are investing, employees, more information about fees, they're going to get so confused that they're going to stop investing. What do you say to that?
It seems odd to me that they would require a participant to take on the most difficult aspect of investing, which is selecting the investments themselves and constructing a proper portfolio. That is far more complicated than just having fees presented to them. When the FDA required food companies to disclose nutritional information on the back of food packages, soup cans, bags of potato chips, whatever, did you stop eating? Did you become overwhelmed and stop eating? Look, participants are going to invest. It's just that we need to give them the right information so that they can construct a portfolio that is not fast food, but is a healthy, well-balanced meal.
What is necessary and what's not in terms of mutual funds charging for their services? They do have to make money somehow, obviously. It's a business.
Sure.
How do you know what's a good, justified fee and what's a ridiculous one?
That is a very good question, and there's some relativity to that. The relativity comes in the presumption that a mutual fund company can, over time, outperform ordinary market returns.
In other words, the whole reason that we hire these companies is because we assume that these professionals will get us a better-than-market return.
That is correct. And what we know is that a simple portfolio of 60% equities, that would be stocks, and 40% bonds, outperforms 90% of the best and brightest portfolio managers in the country over the long term. And so any dollars spent on trying to chase returns when you do not have a guarantee that they will actually yield the results you're seeking are excessive. Now, some people may say, well, those fees are reasonable because the fund manager is actually doing the work to try to get the better returns. I understand that. Are those expenses justified when we know that they're probably not going to be able to outperform the market over the long haul?
If I'm contributing to a 401k plan, a 403b plan, is it possible to say potentially how many people have their fingers in my money?
Yeah, I estimate it's 14 or 15 potential individuals or companies who could be paid from your account for a variety of services. You've got the fund company. You have potentially an independent investment advisor who is directing that company. You have salespeople who could be selling for a commission, record keepers, fund custodians. You have accountants, actuaries, lawyers, outside consultants, and the list goes on. And most of those things that I mentioned are not stated in the prospectus.
Is it possible that any one 401k participant, an employee, could be paying an expense ratio, revenue sharing commissions, 12B1, sub-transfer agent, contract fees, early redemption fees, brokerage commissions, custodial fees, wrap fees, investment advisor fees, and soft dollar revenue?
Absolutely, and I've seen that. And I have seen accounts that pay well over 4% when you add all those up.
Why aren't more people angry about this? And what's the most important thing that can be done to fix this?
Good question. Most people aren't angry because they don't really understand what's happening. They presume that in our society today, everything's disclosed. Why wouldn't it be? what to do about it is regulators and legislators need to understand that we can't have our society paying for services they don't use. And we need to make sure that where the risk is, that full disclosure exists also. So if we have a system that is placing the investment decisions on the shoulders of novices, i.e. participants, regular workers, then we need to honor them by providing them all of the relevant information, even if they don't understand it at first. They're smart. They'll have the capability to learn and understand over time. But we can't withhold it from them under the guise that it will overwhelm them. Don't dishonor us by withholding important elements that's going to reduce our ability to have a dignified retirement in the future. That's not okay, and that's what's got to stop right now.
Matthew Hutchison is an independent fiduciary located in Portland, Oregon. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Tess.
And we've got a link to the proposed regulations, plus an email address to send your comments to the Labor Department. It's all at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
All right, it's that time in the show when we get personal. We answer your money questions. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
How you doing, Tess?
I'm doing all right. You ready for some calls?
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and hit the phones. Our first caller is Sue from Salt Point, New York. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Tess.
What's your question for Chris today?
Well, recently I was the proud inheritor of $1 million.
Wow.
Seems a little strange to say, actually. And my husband and I are both 55 years old. We do not have any money invested. So we have gone to NAPFA. We've gone to a commission-based advisor. And we've read a lot of books and are wondering, should we be looking into a discount brokerage firm like perhaps T. Rowe Price or Vanguard? Because we're just not sure what is the best vehicle for us. The 1% fee with a NAPFA advisor is a little scary.
You know, Chris, you advocate a lot on this program for folks who want a financial advisor to go with a fee-only advisor.
That's correct.
Does that apply to folks who are looking for help with $1 million?
Oh, absolutely.
And all right.
I have a couple of thoughts. First of all, both you and your husband haven't been investing in the market.
Mm-hmm.
My advice is really going to lean toward the conservative side.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you know, if you think about it over the next 10, 20 years, inflation is the big risk for retirees. So the thing that I'd be looking for a fee-only financial planner to do for me is less to manage the money. And so I'd be paying a one-time fee to sort of, you know, to turn to someone and say, look, we really need a bulletproof portfolio to limit the downside, preserve our standard of living. What are some of the trade-offs that we're going to face? Now, you may want then turn to that person and say, okay, can you do this for us? And they're going to charge you a fee for that. Or you can say, you know, these are good ideas, but we can do this on our own and keep the fees down. But we can basically do this on our own. But you're hiring this knowledge. That's why I would recommend fee-only certified financial planner.
But Sue, I wonder if the question is, if you just get a plan from somebody, are you going to feel comfortable enacting that plan?
Oh, that I'm happy with. And we would consider going back to a planner maybe in 2 years or 5 years, and then paying for a review.
Is that a service, Chris, that's generally available?
Absolutely. And there is going to be a cost no matter what. So 1% is not outrageous. I would say 1% is within the realm of normal fees. It's 1% and below. People should consider that a reasonable fee in today's marketplace.
Okay.
All right. Does that help you out, Sue?
It does. Thank you so much.
Terrific. Thanks for the call.
All righty. Bye-bye now.
All right. Well, if you've got some questions about your next money move, let us help. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Randy from Owings Mills, Maryland, emailed us. He and his wife have Roth IRAs. Good for them.
Great.
Now they want to add something that we talk about a lot on this show, which is some tips. They want some tips, some Treasury inflation-protected securities. And he's read up on them, but he's having a hard time finding an easy way to get them. The question is, can he transfer or roll over his Roth in some way that would allow him to take advantage of tips?
All right. Now, what I want to know is, why is it that the U.S. Treasury has the Full Employment Act for Wall Street? Because it's an absolute disgrace. There's this program, Treasury Direct, which we talked about. You can buy your securities. You and I, we can buy our securities directly from the Treasury. Wonderful program.
Right.
However, you cannot buy your tips through your IRA through using Treasury Direct.
Why?
Why can't you do this? I don't know. As far as I'm concerned, they seem to be more solicitous about Wall Street than they're solicitous about the savers. So I think it's a disgrace. It shouldn't happen. You do need to go through, you know, a brokerage house. Now, through your Roth IRA, whoever you have that account with, you can direct them to buy you Treasury inflation-protected securities. The other thing that you can do, there are a number of good mutual funds out there that solely buy Treasury inflation-protected securities. So you can go the mutual fund route, or you can go owning them yourselves, but you will have to work through the financial institution that you have your Roth IRA with. But any financial institution can buy these. U.S. government markets, the biggest market in the world, as we all know, and you don't really pay that much to buy them. It just is kind of a pet peeve of mine that I think the Treasury Direct program should allow people to buy them directly through their IRAs.
So if you decide to go the route of, say, a mutual fund with tips in it, will it be called, say, the Fidelity Tips Mutual Fund or the Vanguard Tips Mutual Fund?
Or they'll have inflation protected or inflation indexed. And one easy way to do it is to go to Morningstar.com. And Morningstar has a lot of information on all the various mutual funds. That's one way that you could do a search and find the mutual funds that focus on the tips market. Now, they may also buy some tips or its equivalent securities overseas. It might not just be U.S. government issued Treasury inflation protected securities. So you want to check that out. You may want to be exposed to other markets. You may not want to be, but you can make that choice.
All right. Well, if you've got cash on your mind, give us a call. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link. And Chris, we'll be back with you a little bit later in the show.
Okay.
So stay tuned for more Getting Personal. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Baby boomers are starting to prepare for their golden years. And for some, that means finally thinking about things like wills and estate planning. In fact, the first 20 years of this millennium will mark the largest transition of wealth from one generation to another in American history, more than $10 trillion. Of course, with all that money hanging in the balance, it's hard to resist a little well-intentioned bribery. Stacey Vanek Smith made that discovery as her parents started getting their affairs in order.
Here's the deal. I'm 31 years old. I am not married, and I do not have children. So imagine my surprise when my mom calls a few months back to tell me she and dad have set up a generation-skipping trust. Basically, that means they're setting aside a chunk of money that will exclusively be available to my theoretical offspring. Translation? The more I thought about it, the more freaked out I got.
I think it's very natural for you to have that kind of reaction.
That's Eileen Gallo. She's a psychotherapist who specializes in issues of money and inheritance. She says wills and trusts are often very fraught. She advised me to be understanding and try to get more information from my parents.
They want in their lifetime probably to experience grandchildren. And they're giving you the little push. But you might not want to be pushed. You need to be the one to communicate with them.
So I asked my mom for the skinny.
It was set up for your 30th birthday. The idea was to have everything in place by the time you were 30.
Did you think I would already have kids?
Well, you don't know, but you hope.
I'm sorry, Mom. Did I mention I'm an only child? Anyway, Mom said with college tuition prices and housing prices being what they are, it would be a good idea to set aside money for my hypothetical kids.
Did you guys worry at all about the fact that there aren't actual grandchildren yet?
When the trust was set up, the assumption basically was and is that there will be.
Yeah, my parents are not settled people. But personal finance expert Jordan Goodman says, from a financial perspective, they're just being smart.
It is a way of transferring assets without estate tax to your grandkids as well as to you. So, yes, there's a definite tax savings.
Goodman says if my parents just left money to me, it would be taxed 45% when I got it, and it would be taxed 45% again when I gave it to my kids. The trust will sidestep a lot of those taxes. And if I don't have kids, I can leave the money to someone else when I die. I asked Goodman how he would recommend handling a situation like this.
I think you should please them have a kid. That would be the best solution to this entire estate planning problem.
Would that be your advice from a personal finance perspective?
It only takes 9 months. It's really not that big a deal, so you should go for it.
Clearly, my parents got to him first. And this type of parental bribery is driving a whole new category in estate planning. They're called incentive trusts. And basically, it means the kids have to jump through certain hoops to get their parents' money. Estate planning lawyer John Gallo says about a quarter of his clients have asked him about incentive plans. He says sometimes getting money is contingent on a college degree, marrying a person of a particular faith, earning a certain amount of money, and it gets a lot weirder.
I'm aware of one incentive trust in which the beneficiary's weight was taken into consideration. If she weighed more than a specified amount, the income from the trust would be cut back because her father was always concerned that she was going to be obese.
Seriously? Is that even legal?
It is legal, and there is a Twinkie trust out there, I can assure you.
Gallo says he's not a huge fan of incentive trusts, but he says that hasn't stopped them from becoming hugely popular.
People tend to create incentive trusts out of fear. It really depends upon what is the particular issue that the parent is facing. Is the parent concerned about drug abuse? Is the parent concerned about the child not being entrepreneurial? It's really an attempt to extend parental authority beyond the grave.
Suddenly, the fact that my parents set up a fund for fictional grandkids doesn't seem so bad. At least it doesn't involve me getting on a scale every month. And anyway, Mom assures me that she and Dad are just trying to make life easier for me.
The idea was to positively affect both your life and your children's lives.
If I have children, right?
Mm-hmm.
Translation. Yeah, where is a Twinkie when you need one? In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
Coming up, learning to live with chronic illness and its costs. And imagine a job where everyone around you is wearing beads and sometimes not much else.
Mardi Gras is a nonstop thing. You're sweating back there, especially on the patio. We got a lot of patio bartenders. The heat out here. They're nonstop for at least 10 to 11 hours.
It's a day in the work life of a Bourbon Street bartender. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Viglund. This week, the California Senate rejected a bill that would have required health insurance for almost everybody in this state. Healthcare advocates watched closely to see what happened because California would have been the largest state to enact such a mandate. Health insurance has become an intensely personal issue for columnist David Lazarus, even though he is covered through his employer, the Los Angeles Times. We spoke with him last fall, shortly after he was diagnosed with diabetes, and we've invited him back for an update. David, what have you discovered since then?
Well, you know, when I replayed our interview from a few months back, you could hear the fear and the anger in my voice as I just embarked on that road. Well, now it's a few months later, and I'm happy to say that I've got my hands around this thing now. I've got my numbers, my blood sugar levels under control. My learning curve is a lot less. I've worked with an endocrinologist about how I dose myself and how I regulate my insulin. I've worked with a dietitian to learn how to eat again, which is very hard. And so you get the hang of something like this. You learn that you're not going to let it manage your life. And when I go to the drugstore now, I know what I'm doing.
So what have you learned about the costs of managing a chronic disease, insulin, needles, other supplies?
They're extensive. In some cases, some diabetics tell me they spend about $10,000 a year on this thing. You're talking about your blood glucose meter. You're talking about the test strips that are required for that. And I do as many as 7 to 10 tests a day. But there are other things as well. You've got your insulin. You've got your needles. You've got the lancets you need to poke your finger, again, 7 to 10 times a day. And so you have a lot of fixed costs attached to a chronic disease.
Can you give us an idea of those fixed costs when you talk about, say, the strips? What does that set you back?
This is where it gets really, really interesting, Tess, because you have roughly 21 million diabetics in the United States right now. According to some estimates, the number of diabetics is going to double to more than 40 million over the next few years, primarily because of the obesity epidemic. So you would think that these economies of scale would bring the costs of much of the diagnostics of diabetes down, but they don't. And in the case of test strips, which is a very good example, each one of these little tiny strips, they retail for $1 each. And a handful of major drug companies that have cornered the market, they're all selling at the same exact price of $1 a piece. Now, if that's not a monopoly, that's clearly an oligopoly, and you're looking at, I would say, cartel-like behavior if none of these companies are able to compete on price. And when I started investigating the cost of test strips, I discovered that, in fact, the cost of manufacturing the test strips, it's closer to 9 cents a strip. That's a 900% markup on a captive market with a chronic disease.
How is it then that insurance companies haven't made demands to bring those costs down, or that even patients themselves have said, you know what, this is ridiculous. Can't we do something about this?
Patients don't seem to have a powerful voice in this equation. This isn't just diabetes now. We could be talking about any chronic disease, whether it's heart disease, AIDS, cancer, thyroid. There do not seem to be patient empowerment avenues here. Now, clearly, there are large organizations. In my case, the American Diabetes Association, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, which are the type 1 guys. These are all big players here, but they are beholden in many ways to the drug industry because they get much of their funding from the drug industry. Hence, they do not splash in the pool when it comes to going into the face of the drug companies.
Any other surprises to your wallet in terms of dealing with this disease?
My relationship with my insurance company has become very troublesome as, you know, they have their different ways that they want to manage my disease for me, which isn't always in sync with my game plan.
Or with your doctor's game
plan. Thank you. And that's the other thing, too, is I do have to see my doctor at very regular intervals now. And I never really paid that much attention to the co-pays and whatnot because I always thought, okay, I'm going in for my physical and there it is. Now I go in regularly and I see a doctor, I see a diabetes educator, I see a dietitian. These things start piling up very, very quickly. And I'll tell you, Tess, the more I have encounters with the U.S. medical system, the more I feel validated in my belief that a single payer system is the way to go for the United States, where we spend $2 trillion annually on health care. And by some estimates, we squander a third of that amount on bureaucratic overhead. Boy, we can be doing a better job.
Well, David Lazarus, thanks for coming in again, and we'll look forward to checking in a couple of months.
Always a pleasure.
David Lazarus is the personal finance columnist with the Los Angeles Times.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Shaken and stirred brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, bond insurers. They're institutions with impeccable credit. When cities have bad credit, bond insurers can get them good insurance rates for a fee. But in the last few years, they backed securities that gambled in subprime loans. Guess what happened? Top bond insurer MBIA lost more than $2 billion in the fourth quarter. Its stock price is down 50% since January 1st. But the company's CEO says it has plenty of capital to keep its license to lend. According to him, MBIA will die another day.
We're back again with Getting Personal, and as always, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, we've got an email from Evangeline in Cleveland.
Okay.
She's a 26-year-old medical resident, and she's very excited about opening a Roth.
Okay.
And we talked about this a little earlier in the show, the Roth IRA. The hospital where she trains offers a SEP, but does not match funds for residents. A representative of the company that manages that plan told her that there is no limit on how much she can contribute to the SEP and that she can legally open up both a Roth and a SEP. In fact, on last week's show, we talked about whether you can have both a 401k account and also a Roth IRA. So here's a question. Can you have a SEP and a Roth?
The answer is yes. You can have a Simplified Employee Pension Plan, or SEP, and a Roth with a caveat. And the caveat is assuming that you meet the income limits, the income qualifications that are tied to a Roth. I'm a little bit confused by the question. Just very quickly, with a SEP, if you work in an organization, the employee actually doesn't make contributions. The employer does. It's one of the differences between a SEP and, say, a 401k. The other thing is there are limits. I know that you've been on this crusade test that there would be no limits in terms of our retirement savings plans, but
why limit your savings for retirement? I don't understand.
Congress isn't listening to you, at least you know, so far. And so when it comes to a SEP, it's 25% of your compensation up to, I believe for 2007, up to $45,000. 2008 tax year, it'll jump up to about $46,000. But the good news is have a SEP and a Roth.
All right. Well, we love talking about ways to ease your financial worries, so do visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, let's go to the phones again. And our caller is getting a jump start on the tax season. Heather is with us from Marquette, Michigan. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
So what, you get excited about doing your taxes?
No, I am quite fearful of my taxes, actually.
Yeah. But you decided to get them out of the way, huh?
Yeah, and we're really looking at going forward in time. So that's a question we've had for a long time. We're hoping that Chris can help us with it.
All right. Well, what is it?
Okay. When springtime and tax time comes around, we would always rather get a refund check rather than pay. Not that I don't want to pay my taxes, but I'd rather give the government more money and then get a refund in the spring. So to accomplish this, we've always filled out our W-2s at work to say married but withhold at a single rate.
Right, yeah.
And so what we're trying to figure out in this next year, because we really want to start aggressively saving in our 401k and IRA, is if we change that status for this next tax year to be married and withhold at a married rate, how can we even calculate what the difference will be?
Yes. There is a mathematical equation that the IRS loves to provide for everybody.
They do. Now, what I have for you is, actually, I think it's a calculator that's going to just really deal with your issue. And it's a paycheck calculator, and it's at dinkytown.net. www.dinkytown.net. And with their payroll deduction calculator, it's not just that you can put in what you've been doing, right? And then you're going to put in what you're thinking about doing and changing the filing status to married. And then also how much are you going to be putting into your retirement savings and how that will affect your tax bite. And so hopefully what you can just do is just plug in some numbers and play around with the numbers a little bit and make it so that you're not giving more money to the government than you should be doing. I mean, it's nice not to have to write a check in April, but you haven't had use of that money either.
Chris, let me ask you a quick question about those calculators. I don't know if I've tried Dinkytown yet, but I find that a lot of them have no room for you to put in, say, how much your itemized deductions are.
Correct.
And, you know, and other factors that come into play when you figure out how much tax you're going to owe or not. Is there anything that is really comprehensive?
The calculator that I mentioned, you know, go through, you put in your pay period, your gross pay, your filing status, your 401k. However, You're absolutely right. Most calculators, and even this one, are limited. You know, the more comprehensive way to do it is to go and do a TurboTax and actually do your taxes, and then you can really figure things out.
But Chris, isn't it right that when you do these calculations, the IRS doesn't care how you calculate your own withholding? As long as you give them the money they're owed, they don't look at whether you filed as single or a married rate.
No, the marriage police are not knocking on your door to say, now, are you really married or not? I mean, basically what it is, and Heather's been doing, and there's a lot of people that do it, which is that they just really don't want to be surprised in April.
Exactly.
But I really think for most people, if you can avoid doing that, if you are married, you know, to file jointly, you know, go through it. But the big thing that you want to do is have use of the money yourself in your savings rather than in the government savings.
All right. Does that help you out, Heather?
That is wonderful. Thank you so much, Chris. We've looked everywhere for this answer, so I'm excited.
Enjoy your taxes.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Chris, thanks, as always, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Jess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Victims of Hurricane Katrina lost a bid this week to force some accountability on the Army Corps of Engineers. A federal judge ruled reluctantly that the Corps cannot be sued for the levee failures that caused the entire city to flood. Apparently, the government has legal immunity when flood control projects don't work. But despite that news, the city is partying this week. Fat Tuesday arrives on Tuesday, marking the end of a weeks-long freakout called Mardi Gras. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we follow some locals into a famous Irish bar called Pat O'Brien's to pay a visit to the bartender.
We're trying to get a hurricane, We're trying to get a hurricane. This supposed to be the play, New Orleans. This supposed to, see what I'm talking about? There it is, right there.
There it is.
We've been the Superman and them things.
My name's Ryan Mason. I've been at Pat O'Brien's now for about 10 years. Specialty drinks, most of them are all named after a storm. Your most main one, though, would be the hurricane. That basically what created this place and what made this place what it is. A hurricane, basically 4 ounces of amber rum, 4 ounces of hurricane passion fruit mix. I tell people it's more like a fruit punch to it. It's a lot of alcohol and a lot of kick to it. I could see people put down about 3 of them and they could walk, but I would never suggest anybody go over that. I mean, you see a bunch of guys come in, when they drink about 4 or 5 of them, they're staggering around, throwing up sometimes, trying to make it to a bathroom, they don't even realize where they are at that time. I mean, running into people. I mean, most of the time, you have to take 2 or 3 of us to walk them out the door, try to get them a cab, or at least sit them outside to where they're not bothering the customers that are in the place. Mardi Gras is a nonstop thing for about 1.5 to 2 weeks. I work construction jobs too, just as hard. Start till finish, you don't stop. You're sweating back there, especially on the patio. We got a lot of patio bartenders. The heat out here, they're nonstop for at least 10 to 11 hours. You don't have your weekend to go out and party with some of your friends or something like that. Every weekend, holiday, you miss all that. Everybody thinks bartending is a great job, which it is, but you've got your downfall to it too. We have 5 different bars in here. You work your way up to your best bar. Right now I do work the best bar, which is the main bar. I mean, there could be nights you make $300 to $400 a night. Older crowd, more mature crowd, you're better tippers. They're more sociable. Drunk people aren't really someone that tips that well. They're a little bit harder to deal with. Now, I mean, you are in the French Quarter, so you do see a lot of stuff that you probably shouldn't be said on radio or... I mean, there are people having sex in the street. You see a lot of this. Bartenders have their reputation. You know, girls meet bartenders, we go home with everybody. That's not always true. Sometimes it's true. I wouldn't say it's not. Every job has to have a perk. That's ours.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Jeff Tyler. If you're a frequent flyer between the U.S. and our neighbors to the north and south, that's Canada and Mexico for the geographically challenged, you know you need to produce a passport to get back into the States. But if you've been driving or boating across the border, things have been a little more casual. State Department spokesman Cy Ferenchak explains.
Up to January 30th, Customs and Border Protection officers have the latitude of accepting what they call an oral declaration without documentation.
In other words, you could say you were a U.S. citizen, and if the border cop bought it, welcome to America. Well, no longer. As of last Thursday, to get back home by land or sea, you'll be required to produce some paperwork, no matter how honest you look. Here's the checklist.
One document, like a passport, or it can be two documents, like a birth certificate and a government-issued photo ID card.
Most commonly a driver's license, but anything issued by the government with your name and photo on it will do. Here's the good news. Land and sea travelers who want something more compact than an address book-sized passport to lug back and forth across the border now have another option.
The passport card is a credit card-sized card that you can carry in your wallet. You'll fill out an application at a passport acceptance facility. If you're a new applicant, a passport card for an adult will cost $45.
Compare that to $100 for a standard passport. The first card should ship out this spring. Keep in mind, though, it's only good for land and sea travel among the U.S., Mexico, Canada, and the Caribbean. And if you want it or a regular passport, for that matter, apply now. It takes 4 to 6 weeks to turn around an application, which means that spring break trip to Tijuana could be in jeopardy. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, everybody's a critic, right? But that doesn't mean you should trust those hotel reviews on the internet.
You don't know who these people are. These are not your friends or your neighbors or people that know you and you don't know them. Take it all with a grain of salt.
Caveat emptor internetto. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Janae Darden, James Richter, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.